As Arthur Priya says, I've been doing quite a lot of talks, and it's always a pleasure to give a talk, I must say. I really enjoy the process of giving them. I don't really enjoy the process of writing them so much. The real work is in the writing, but this bit is very pleasurable. And what I really like about Padmaloka giving a talk here is it's so quiet. It's so quiet. You're there, you're listening, I'm talking, you're listening to me. It's so quiet. I really like that. Where I give talks in India, it's not like that. I give talks in centres and there is so much racket and chaos going on all around me. And a few years ago, I was giving a talk in a centre in India, and it was a busy street outside. There was a lot of noise, but people were really listening. And it was a small gathering, about 100, something like this. And but there was someone outside, just by the entrance, revving up a motorbike. He was working on the motorbike. But all the fumes were sort of coming in like this. And it was really annoying, you know. And afterwards, people said, oh, very good talk, Sadaraj, you know, we loved it. I said, yeah, but that motorbike was really annoying, wasn't it? They said, oh, what motorbike was that? What motorbike? They're completely used to it. So I really like it here, where it's nice and quiet. I mean, I love India. It's wonderful, but it's nice to be in this environment. So, I'll start with a bit of a short story. In 1998, Sangharakshita brought out a new book of aphorisms called A Stream of Stars. It's a great book. I love aphorisms, and Sangharakshita's aphorisms. He's got another book called Pieces of Fire. It's been around for a very long time, and it's wonderful stuff. It's dynamite. And well, when he brought a new book of aphorisms out, I was really excited. But one particular quote in the book really got my attention. So here it is. Are you ready? Without unremitting effort, nothing truly great is ever achieved. All the great artists seem to have been great workers. Perhaps this was because they loved their work. So I'll just read it again. Without unremitting effort, nothing truly great is ever achieved. All the great artists seem to have been great workers. Perhaps this was because they loved their work. By the way, there's a whole set of notes on this whole talk which you'll get handed out on your way out, so you don't need to bother taking notes if you don't want to. You'll all get certain notes, but you're not going to get them before I've done the talk. So this quote that I heard, it took me right back to my childhood in the Lake District in Cumbria. Yeah, I was brought up in Cumbria in the 60s, the swinging 60s. Well, it wasn't really swinging in Cumbria where I was, I can tell you. So there I was. That was me, little kid, growing up in Cumbria. There I was, little lad, little Richard. Richard was my name. And I was a forester's son. And we lived in woodland cottages with no electricity and lots of animals and that kind of thing. We lived on a small holding. But from an early age, I wanted to draw and paint. I loved going out and drawing and painting things. That's what I wanted to do. I'm a reasonably kind of accomplished man these days, I think. But back then, I wasn't. And school was quite a problem for me. I didn't really get on very well at school. I could draw and paint, though. That was really good. But the other subjects were more difficult. Today, we would say that I had special needs. Yeah, I had learning difficulties. But they had a much more blunt term for it back then. They said I was backward. I was in the bottom set for everything. I was in the thicko set, as they called it. That's what they called it back then. Not very politically correct, but that's what I was. And but I could draw and paint, and I loved doing it. That's what I did. And then when I was about that age, when I was about 9, an old colonel came and visited. This sort of old retired colonel. And he had a big set of volumes, an encyclopedia of the history of art. You used to get it in weekly instalments, 40 instalments built into a big encyclopedia. And he came along and said, "Do you think that young Richard would like to read these?" And did I want to read them? I love to read them. And it was wonderful. I think I spent about 2 years just reading them over and over again. And it started with cave paintings. Then it moved to the Egyptians and the Phoenicians. Then it was the art of ancient Greece, the Italian Renaissance, yeah, European, the Dutch school, the French Fauves and the Impressionists, the British and the modern artists. Yeah, it was wonderful. Botticelli, Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, Van Dyck, Van Eyck, Van Gogh, Rubens, Rembrandt, Monet, Gauguin, Doré, Toulouse-Lautrec, Turner, Constable, Stanley Spencer, Picasso, ancient art, Western art, Islamic art, modern art, mannerism, Baroque, Rococo, neoclassicism, the Cubists, realism, romanticism, African tribal art, and Japanese woodcuts. I studied it all, I read it all, and I absolutely loved it. I really, really loved it. I loved it all for different reasons, all the different artists. I copied the pictures, I read, I thought, I looked at things in the way that they looked at things, and that was my world. That was what I was involved in. I was completely absorbed. I even loved Walt Disney and Rolf Harris. Yeah, I loved Rolf Harris on the telly. There he was, painting away. Can you tell what it is yet? I loved Rolf Harris, and I had the great pleasure to meet him 8 years ago, and it was such a pleasure. Anyway, I decided then and there that I wanted to be an artist when I grew up. That's what I wanted to do. And, it didn't quite work out like that, but that's what I wanted to do. And I actually dug out a little picture from the family archives here. It's a bit vague, but you can actually see me with a berry on and a smock sat at an easel. I mean, what a poser. I was really getting into it in a really big way. It really mattered to me. It really mattered to me. So I still do paint and draw. I do commissions. Mainly these days my life is focused on the Dharma. But I will say that art is an important, crucial aspect to my Dharma life. I can't live without art. I am an artist and I need to be involved in that in some way in my Dharma life. And that is how it will always be. One of the things I noticed studying all these artists all those years ago was that most, if not all of the artists, were great workers. So this was the connection with the Sangharakshita quote. They knew all about long, hard graft. Yeah, they didn't mind it at all. They were quite happy to burn the midnight oil on the Sistine Chapel or out in the fields like Van Gogh. They didn't mind doing that. They loved their work. And they didn't mind if they'd rather die than give it up. It was so important to them. They were passionate. It's what they live for. And I think Monet is a very good example of this, for instance. You know, Monet with the water lilies? He painted every single day of his life and a lot of his childhood as well. And also there's our own Aloka. I really rejoice in Aloka, this wonderful new rupa that he's produced. Aloka is a great worker. He works so hard, his health's not good, but he really, really works at what he does. He's not a dilettante. He's really serious. I remember when I told my father I wanted to be an artist, he just scoffed. He just scoffed at me. He said, I think I was about 15, and I told him quite seriously, "I'm going to be an artist, Dad." And he said, that's rubbish. That's not a real career. Artists spend all their time drinking wine and drawing naked women. And that's what he said. And at the time, I have to say, that seemed okay, actually. That seemed okay. Anyway, I find all this very interesting, this thing about work and loving your work. And this reminds me of another quote from Sangharakshita. Here we go. Sometimes I think work, real work, work in which one believes, is the greatest enjoyment in life. Work in which one believes is the greatest enjoyment in life. Well, perhaps it is. Yeah, perhaps it can be. I don't know about you. I don't know about your experience of work and whether that's the greatest enjoyment in your life. I don't know about that. Perhaps we can hear about that later. But I know that for me, there are times when it can be. Not this week, it's just gone, but quite a lot of the time, work is really, really important in my life and very, very enjoyable and satisfying. So there's this link between enjoyment and energy around work. So I just want to say something about energy now, a little bit about it. And the word for energy in Buddhism is virya, and everybody has it. You've got it, I've got it, we all have it. And Buddhism tells us that we can cultivate it and we can refine it. Yeah? Successful spiritual practice depends on you having virya. It's a positive mental event. It's a spiritual faculty. And there are 5 spiritual faculties. I'm not going to talk about them. I'm just going to tell you what they are. They're a complete path in themselves, the 5 spiritual faculties. They're our approach to our Dharma lives. And I've even done a little drawing. I don't know whether you can really see it, actually. So you've got virya here. You've got Shraddha, or faith, as in my name. You've got Samadhi, or concentration. And you've got Prajna, or wisdom. And it's all mediated by Smriti, mindfulness. Mindfulness is the kind of faculty which you can't have too much of. It's not possible. And they're a whole teaching in themselves. I'm not going to say very much about them here, because I think they deserve a whole talk of their own. But it's all about balance. Balancing those faculties in your spiritual life if you're going to make progress. And virya is a really important faculty, one of those faculties. And virya doesn't really translate as energy, actually. Energy is not a very good translation of virya, really. It's more than that. It also means strength. Virya means strength. It also means intentness. It's about how you go about things, particularly in an ethical kind of way. Yeah? It's a powerful inclination towards the skillful, the kusala. So it's not just about being a do-gooder either. It's not in that sort of upper-class Victorian lady kind of way. Upper-class modern lady, actually, for that matter. It's not just about doing good things for their own sake. It's more subtle than that. One translation of virya is diligence. And Sangharakshita talks a lot about the different kinds of diligences in Know Your Mind. Very good book. But probably the most common translation of virya is energy in pursuit of the good. Energy in pursuit of the good. And the good, in this case, is our good. Our good, your good. Your spiritual life, the good of your spiritual life, and the good of your human life. And also, it's the good of others, other people around you and in the world. Their spiritual good, their human good. And virya's also got a kind of heroic aspect to it as well. Heroism. Yeah, it's positive, it's dynamic, it's joyful, and it's creative. And I find it quite interesting, we got the kind of Padmaloka program this year, which raised a few eyebrows when it came out, because it's unashamedly heroic. It's got a sort of very 1950s illustration of the theme seems to be all about mountaineering, and heroism. There's a chap on the top of what could be probably Everest, could even be Sir Edmund Hillary or Sherpa Tenzing on the top of Everest in the 1950s. And I really like it, and because there is a heroic element and quality to Buddhism, and particularly in this area of virya. So virya is life, yeah? Virya is energy. The more spiritually alive we are, the more energy we will have. traditional approaches to virya are, well, the sixth stage of the Noble Eightfold Path, perfect effort, and specifically the four right efforts. And I'm going to say a little bit more about those in a minute. So virya is needed at every stage of the spiritual life. So if you're meditating, you're studying, you're communicating, you're going on retreat, you will need virya. You will need that energy. Yeah? Virya ultimately springs from faith, from Shraddha, your faith in the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But there are a number of things that look a little bit like virya in the spiritual life, but they're not. They look like it and we can get confused. And one of them is Buddhist busyness. Buddhist busyness, you know, where people are running around doing lots and lots of things for the Dharma, you know, really, really getting exhausted, not enough sleep, not much time. Sorry, I'm very busy, I can't talk to you. That kind of thing. Sometimes it happens in Buddhist centres. It even happens in retreat centres. You get these very busy people, don't you? And that's not virya. Yeah, that's exhaust. That leads to exhaustion. Yeah? You draw uncashable checks on the bank of experience if you do that. Yeah? Think about it. You draw uncashable checks on the bank of experience. That's where that leads. It leads to a dead end. And it leads to chronic fatigue. Believe me, I deal with it all the time in my job. The other thing that looks a bit like virya is the numbers game. People play the numbers game. So, oh yes, I'm going on 13 retreats in the next 3 years. I've got them all booked out. I'm getting them all in. I'm getting things in. I'm meeting people all the time. I'm racking it all up. I'm doing loads and loads of Buddhist things. Yeah, the numbers game. It looks very impressive, but it's not virya. So watch out for that one. So here's another quote from Sangharakshita. All these are on your sheet, by the way. If one is healthy, one has energy. And if one has energy, one naturally wants to put it into something. That is, one wants to work. Whether the work consists of digging the soil or painting a picture. So work is a natural outlet for virya. And in my work as a welfare officer, I'm regularly encountering people in the workforce who haven't got much energy. They've got problems with it. It's not flowing. They're tired all the time. You know? Unusually, I find that they're not engaged or interested in their work. Yeah, and I think it's a very, very sort of sad situation where you're doing a job but you don't like it, you're not engaged. It's really difficult, isn't it? And I do empathise with those people. I think that's really tough. And I always say to people, I think you probably need to do something else with your life, something that you really enjoy doing. It's so important. Okay, I want to just sort of change tack a bit now and move on to team-based right livelihood. I want to say a little bit about what that is. Is there anybody here who hasn't heard of team-based right livelihood before? Stick your hand up if you haven't heard of it. Anybody? Good, good. There's a few people who haven't. Right, that's useful. What is it? What is team-based right livelihood? Well, quite simply, it's Buddhists working together in a skillful project using the team format. It's as simple as that, actually. It doesn't necessarily have to be a business. But there you are, you're cooperating together on a project, working to achieve an end, but you're working in a team. There's more than one of you. It could be a centre team, actually, or it could be a team here, like the support team or the ordination team here. They all work together as a team on a project. That's a right livelihood. That's a team-based right livelihood. Or it could be like Karanar Trust, a charity, going door knocking, fundraising. That's a team-based right livelihood. But usually the term is applied to businesses, generally speaking. We don't actually have that many team-based right livelihood businesses in Sri Ratna. More's the pity. The most prominent of these is Windhorse Evolution. Most folk have heard of it. Has anybody not heard of Windhorse Evolution? Stick your hand up if you haven't. Ooh, everybody's heard of it. Great. Oh, right, I'm pleased. Okay. Well, we've been trading since 1980, and we employ 250 men and women within the business. And in that time, we've given away in Downer in excess of £5 million. Not a bad figure, really. A useful sum of money, £5 million over the years, to Buddhist projects. So, you know, we've got a headquarters, a HQ, in Cambridge. That's where I work, where Arthur Priya works. And in Cambridge at HQ, we've got about 105 people work there. Lots and lots of people work there. Currently, we have 21 nationalities working there. And we also have 19 shops, soon to become 20 shops, out in the world. Evolution gift shops, some of you might have visited them, bought things there. Some of you might have even worked in them. I certainly have. We've got lots of them. We're about to open another one in Reading. And we have lots of sales vans, people who go out in big Mercedes vans selling stuff to shops. So we're a gift trader. We sell gifts and homewares, and we do that in trade shows, through shops, by the internet, the use of the internet. Well, it's quite interesting stuff. It's all fair, it's all ethical trade. I've got a few samples of the kinds of things that we sell. Most of what we sell isn't sort of necessary to human survival. It doesn't do any harm to anybody, but it's actually quite frivolous. A lot of what we sell is quite frivolous. This interesting little item, Nag Champa incense, is one of the all-time best-selling lines ever. As we speak, a Saturday, this is being sold all over the country as we speak, constantly. It's just phenomenal how much. I mean, it's lovely stuff. The current bestseller is this particular item. There it is. Driftwood picture frames. We just sell thousands and thousands and thousands of them. People absolutely love them. So, yeah, everything's fair trade and green and all the rest of it. No one gets exploited. And we buy a lot of our stuff from Bali, Thailand, China, India, Guatemala, Kenya. And, yeah, we've got teams of salesmen and buyers and accountants and warehouse workers like Arthur Priya. Also, we give money to social projects around the world. There's an orphanage in Thailand which we fund. Kids who wouldn't have anywhere to live. There's schools in Guatemala which we build, and children get an education. There are disabled children in Bali who we buy wheelchairs for and have a day centre so they can go to. And we buy computers for kids in China in very poor rural areas. We do an awful lot of good. And that also includes the good that is done to the men and women who work there over the years, people like me. And it helps them to grow and develop spiritually. A lot more I could say about windows. Oh yes, and we have a stupa, right, an enormous stupa, right in the middle of our warehouse. Mm-hmm. I think it might be the biggest stupa in Sri Lanka, I think so. Yeah. It's a beautiful thing, and we practice in the middle of our warehouse amongst all the forklift trucks and the rest of it. So our warehouse, our offices and our shops and our vans are not like retreat centres. Yeah, they're not like Buddhist centres or Buddha fields at all. It's not that kind of environment at all. It's all about the world of work. We are Buddhists working in the world. Yeah, and our shops are very colourful and bright and interesting places, and they're full of the general public. General public's just coming in all day and buying things. So you're very welcome at any time to visit our HQ in Cambridge at any time. You're very welcome to come and have a look around. And of course, visit our website or Facebook, and you can go in our shops and buy things if you want to. So team-based right livelihood and Windhorse is not for everyone. Most Tri Ratna Buddhists won't be engaging with it at all. they either can't do, their circumstances, or they're not interested. And that's fair enough. That's fair enough. I'm not here to try and recruit you to Windhorse Evolution. Well, not necessarily, anyway. Windhorse Evolution and Team BH's Right Livelihood has become a minority sport within Tree Ratner. Yeah? Who knows what will happen in the future? It might grow again. New kinds of team-based right livelihoods might happen in new and interesting ways in the future. I really hope that that happens. But I thought I would tell you a bit about it and about our experience. For myself, I've worked in the business 21, 22 years. It's my life. I love it. Just like the art, I really, really love it. I want to serve, yeah? And I've done lots of different jobs. And currently I'm a welfare officer for 250 staff. That's Buddhists and non-Buddhists within the business. So I get around and see a lot. It's great work, I love it. And I've grown, and I've changed, and I've deepened my going for refuge in the process of all that. I've moved along, I've progressed along the path. And at times, I've been challenged to my core. The core of who I am, I've been challenged by the work. I've even been positively humiliated at times. And I've got to know myself and my limitations very clearly. And I found surprising fonts of creativity within myself, which I didn't know I had. I didn't know they were there. I didn't know I was capable of some of the things that I've done. I sometimes look back and I think, how did I do that? I wanted to be an artist. And I ended up... I don't know how that happened. But I've got to know about spiritual practice very deeply. I've got to know what works in spiritual practice at work. I know what works and what seems to be useless. So here's another quote from Sangharakshita. Unless one solves the problem of right livelihood, or rather the problem of wrong livelihood, to some extent at least, spiritual development can be quite difficult. So what I think he's saying here is that work is an important aspect of your overall spiritual life. Work is there. You've got to deal with it. You've got to deal with your work in life. Yeah? Unless you're lucky enough to have a private income, or unlucky enough, it depends on how you look at it, you've got to go to work. You've got to have some kind of career. I don't propose to go into the subject of right livelihood itself today, because it's quite a big subject. But I will give you Sangharakshita's criteria for a team-based right livelihood. And first of all, the business is run on ethical lines. It's the five precepts that count. Secondly, the business should provide financial support to all those working in it to allow a reasonable standard of living. Thirdly, the business should provide a framework of spiritual practice to aid a deepening going for refuge. The framework should especially emphasise friendship within the business. And fourthly, the business should make a profit in order to give dana, generosity for altruistic activity. So that's team-based right livelihood. It's ethical, it supports its workers financially, it provides a spiritual friendship, especially friendship, and the business makes money to give away. Of course, Windhorse Evolution does all these things. Not always to the extent that we would like, but it does. So how is it a practice? How do we make that a real spiritual practice? How do we manifest virya in the world through doing that? And the simple answer is by working in the world, in the maelstrom of the commercial marketplace. Yeah, we make it our workers' practice. Yeah, we're a sangha at work. We're not a sangha at the Buddha Center or a sangha on retreat. We're a sangha at work, in the working environment. Yeah, we're a lotus blooming in the middle of the mud. We're a Dharma sun shining in the nighttime jungle. After all, most of us spend an awful lot of our time, probably a third of our lives, at work. It's a lot of your life, isn't it? Earning a living. It's a major part of your life. It's a major creative expenditure of time. and of energy. So most of us have to work. Yeah, all our identity, our time, our training, our education goes towards our career and working life. You know, unless you are lucky enough to have a private income, or unlucky enough, as I say. I'm not complaining, by the way, but the only private income that I've ever had is the £10 that my son sometimes tucks in my top of my shirt pocket when he's saying goodbye. He goes, "There you go, Dad, there's something for you." So there are so many practices that folks practice within Windhorse Evolution, team-based track livelihood. I recently did a survey. I went round about 40 people at random, and this is what they all said to me. I'll just read them out. I won't comment on them. I asked people, "Well, what's your workers' practice? How do you engage?" So just listen to the diversity of this. The four right efforts, friendship, the path of responsibility, the worldly winds, the four tantric rites, going forth and the simple life, puja and devotion at work, the diligent use of the 5 and 10 precepts, mindfulness and metta at work, the 5 spiritual faculties, serving the Bodhisattva ideal, serving Padmasambhava, internationality, rejoicing in merits, friendship, finding creative solutions, realizing impermanence, and making money for the Dharma. Oh yes, and finally, overcoming my resistance to washing up and cleaning toilets. I was particularly impressed with that last one, actually. And all this is going on within van cabs. It's going on forklift truck seats, office desks, at shop counters and stock rooms, and in directors' meetings. Yeah, people are just practicing in all their particular way. Oh yes, and there's another really important practice, and that's the development of the arts. We have rock bands, folk music, choirs, poetry groups, art exhibitions, theatre, drama and Kayleys. We have this very, very serious thing called fun. F-U-N. We have a lot of fun. We really do enjoy what we're doing together and being with each other. It's great. It's really, really good. At this stage, I must actually rejoice in someone's merits. Pamela, we've got a chap here called Lee Smith. Are you here, Lee? There he is. He's at the back. Lee's worked with us last year. And he's doing what is on the face of it quite an interesting job. He's picking orders in a warehouse. But he's written a whole piece. It's really impressive, called Picking as Practice. You should read it. It's really good. It talks about awareness of purpose, awareness of others, awareness of self. It's fantastic. Awareness of things, awareness of reality. He uses that practice of picking orders to go deeper into the Dharma. So I really appreciate what he's done and he's written, and I really rejoice in that. It shows what you can do in what can be a dull job. You can turn that into your spiritual practice. I'm really impressed. So that's the sort of thing that goes on. Different people work in different ways, and it's up to you. We don't legislate. So at this stage, I'd like to talk about Sutton's Law. I'd like to talk about bank robbery and Sutton's Law in relation to team-based right livelihood and Virya. Sutton's Law is something that you find in pharmacology, it's found in medical schools, and it's sometimes found in accountancy and IT. And Sutton's Law states that when diagnosing, one should first consider the obvious, yeah, to first confirm or rule it out. So in other words, always consider the obvious question. And it's in relation to this chap, actually. It's called Willie Sutton. Willie Sutton is dead now. But he used to be, in the United States, he was the United States' most prolific bank robber. Yet he was at large for 30 years in the States, and they couldn't deal with him. And he robbed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of banks. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that bank robbery is a right livelihood. But he was very, very effective at what he did. And apparently he made Jesse James and Dillinger look like amateurs. He was so good. And he didn't carry a gun. When he was finally arrested in 1952 and sent down, a journalist, as he was being carted off by the feds, a journalist asked him, said, "Mr. Sutton, why do you rob banks?" And he said, "Well, because that's where the money is." It's kind of obvious, isn't it? That's where the money is. And this quote became quite legendary. And people use it in quite a serious way in all sorts of serious professions in life. They call it Sutton's Law. Because always ask the obvious question and think in the obvious way. Because we're so complex, aren't we, as human beings? We're so clever that we often don't think about the obvious. Yeah? So Sutton's Law is very useful in relation to team-based right livelihood. So, Sadaraja, why do you work in team-based right livelihood? Well, that's where the energy is. Not where the money, that's where the energy is. So I call this Sadaraja's Law. So if you want to develop the spiritual faculty of virya, then team-based right livelihood is a good place to do it. It's not the only place, but it's a very good place. Yeah? Because your practice at work will show very, very quickly. If you engage in team-based right livelihood, your Buddhist practice will be on display to everyone very, very quickly. Yeah? The world of work is very demanding. It's very revealing. Your qualities, or otherwise, of body, speech and mind will become very obvious very quickly. You'll get objective feedback from the situation. Your skills and weaknesses will be revealed to customers, to your colleagues and practitioners, and to yourself. Yeah? If you're trying to develop, for instance, patience, and you're working on a counter, selling in a shop, and old people come along and they're taking a long time fiddling with their change, and you're getting annoyed with them, yeah, you're not doing very well with your practice of patience. That will come up over and over again. So team-based right livelihood practice needs to be wholehearted and energetic. Yeah, and you need to be a reliable and competent person. Your energy needs to be bright. It needs to be creative and positive and focused on the good. Or you probably won't enjoy it. Unless you can make it like that, you probably won't enjoy what you're doing. You might become bored. You might become listless, unengaged, and you will pirate the energy of those around you. Your colleagues at work might find you draining to spend time with. And this has happened, unfortunately. It does happen. Energy in pursuit of the good in team-based right livelihood becomes very obvious. So one of the crucial ways that you work, that one can practice in team-based right livelihood, is learning from your mistakes. I think this is such an important right livelihood practice. When people have unfortunate experiences at work or in life, one of the important questions you can ask yourself is, what have I learned? What have I learned from this experience? So something bad happens to you, happens to me. Often we just want to put it behind us and move on. It's kind of understandable, isn't it? But actually, you need to learn from that. So here's another quote from Sangharakshita. You learn what it is you are trying to do in the process of trying to do it. So the Dalai Lama tells us, learning is the only compensation for misfortune. Learning is the only compensation for misfortune. Okay, things go wrong all the time in life, but make sure you get the learning. And in Windhorse Evolution, we have made many, many mistakes. Business mistakes, spiritual mistakes, mistakes in how we treat individuals in the business, mistakes of ethos. We've bought the wrong equipment. Yet we've sold products badly. We've bought the wrong products. We've hired the wrong people. We've bought the wrong vehicles. We've applied Buddhist ethics in a naive or pedantic way. It's all very human, isn't it, really? And we keep doing this from time to time. Though what I do think happens is we usually do it once. What I've noticed is we make that mistake and we make it once. And then we've learned and we don't do that again. And I think that's such an important spiritual practice. And it doesn't always go on. I worked for many years for BT, the telephone company. They were not learning from their mistakes a lot of the time. Speaking personally, and going back to my childhood, I made a very big mistake. Shortly after I got involved in art, I also I got very interested in Robinson Crusoe. Do you remember Robinson Crusoe? And I was into kind of desert islands and being on marooned on. I've got strong imagination actually, and I discovered that there was an island on Morecambe Bay near where I live. Some of you might have heard of Morecambe Bay. It's got this fast-moving tide, and about 10 years ago, a lot of Chinese cockle pickers were drowned on Morecambe Bay. Hundreds of people have been drowned on Morecambe Bay. It's really, really serious. But when I was about 10 or 11, me and my friend decided we wanted to visit Chapel Island. I've got a little picture of it here, actually. There's Chapel Island. So there's a massive bay, and there's this little island, this romantic, mysterious island, a medieval island in the middle of the bay. And it's got a ruined chapel on it with a bell, and you can hear the bell clanging. And once I knew that Chapel Island was there, I wanted to go. I wanted to go there and find it. And my parents have been saying to me for years, don't ever go near Chapel Island. Don't go to Chapel Island. It's really, really dangerous. Don't go there, whatever you do. Which basically ensured that I was going to do it. So it was a beautiful summer's morning, and my friend and I set off at 7 o'clock in the morning. We didn't tell our parents where we were going. There were no mobile phones in those days. We took food, and finally we got to the island, and it was so exciting. I felt like Robinson Crusoe. We lit a fire, we had sausages and eggs, and we were all this food. And then we sort of noticed, quite suddenly to our shock, that we were completely surrounded by water. The tide had come in within 20 minutes, and we were there. What were we going to do? We were so shocked about it, and we hadn't thought about checking out the time of the tides. So we had to wait 12 hours. 12 hours is a long time when you're 11 years of age, stuck on a marooned on an island. What was quite interesting was I got home probably about 8 or 9 o'clock. My parents were watching TV, and we never told them what had happened. And they said, oh, you know, where have you been? And parenting was different in those days. These days, I'd probably be taken into care, you know. So in team-based right livelihood, learning from your mistakes is an important spiritual practice. Yeah, things will show very quickly. What have I learned? How can I use that? If you lose your temper, you get into a bad mental state, you know, it can result in a large dent in the van that you're driving. Yeah, that's what can happen. It shows very quickly. But there are other ways that people practice spiritually, and I've mentioned quite a few of them. Sangharakshita, another quote from Sangharakshita, here you go. So long as you are aiming at enlightenment, you will be relating directly or indirectly to everybody else who's aiming at enlightenment. And that's the only form of relating that really matters. And this is true within team-based right livelihood. We're aiming at enlightenment. Yeah, all the wealth creation, all the profits, all the invoicing, all the team meetings, all the business strategy, all the vehicle maintenance. At the end of it all, it's there so we can aim at enlightenment. So it's a little bit like climbing a mountain. I mean, Padmalokas sort of used that image of climbing a mountain. Aiming at enlightenment, one of the traditional images, is climbing a mountain and reaching the peak of the mountain, hopefully one day at some point. I've got a photograph here of Hillary and Tenzin on top of Everest in the 50s, when they actually really got to the peak. It was an incredible achievement for somebody in those days. What climb that was. I also got a photograph of what it looks like on the top of Everest. So when you reach the top of Everest, the top of the mountain, that's actually what it would look like. It's an extraordinary vista, the highest point of the world. And well, maybe that's a kind of analogy for enlightenment. It's not the same, but it's an analogy. And well, all this work that we're doing in Right Livelihood, it's a bit like climbing technique. It's like experience. You're getting experience. You won't get to enlightenment. You won't get to the peak without technique, without experience, without skills and equipment. Yeah, in climbing, if you get that wrong, you die. You die pretty quickly. If you get that wrong in team-based Right Livelihood, it just becomes an ordinary business that's not actually making much money and you're not getting very well paid. An important team-based Right Livelihood, I think, which everyone can practice, is the four right efforts. I'm going to say a little bit about this now before I finish. The four right efforts is something that anyone can practice, but it's pretty common within our business. And the first, so it's preventing, eradicating, developing and maintaining. And the first one is preventing unskillful mental states, preventing the arising of unarisen unskillful mental states. So you're looking out for things which could happen. I'm talking about hatred or ill will. Talking about anger, deceit, arrogance, jealousy, unmindfulness. These are unskillful mental states. And, well, they can arise when you're working. Yeah, there you are, working away on your computer, and it's not doing what you want it to do. Before you know what, you're kind of getting like that about it. You're getting really, really upset. So it requires effort to make sure that that doesn't actually happen. Yeah? It's a practice at work. It's a particular kind of practice. The second one, the second effort, is eradicating arisen unskillful mental states. So, okay, sometimes negative mental states happen. They're there. You might be in one at the moment. I don't know. I'm not. But if you do get into a negative mental state, you become upset. Yeah, your payroll, sometimes payroll goes wrong at work. And people get very, very upset. They don't get paid on the right day. And they go into the payroll department and they're very angry. And poor old Amaya, he has to deal with that. People get very angry with him. And he said, look, I'm really sorry, and you'll get it tomorrow. And but they're already very angry. Money is a very emotive issue. And harsh words can come from that, harsh actions. So if that's already happened for you at work, you need to deal with it. And I don't mean stamping on that mental state. I mean dealing with it skillfully and smoothly and with awareness. Yeah. So moving from anger to a more balanced perspective. From ill will to something more like friendliness. From chaos and unmindfulness to groundedness and calm awareness. That kind of thing. You need to work with it. So it's quite a specific kind of effort that's needed there. Thirdly, you've got developing, as yet, unarisen, skillful mental states. So this is the more positive aspect. So this is the part of perfect effort that is active in developing positive mental states. And meditation is central in doing that. So I'm talking about compassion, talking about mindfulness and metta-friendliness, sympathetic joy, alertness, empathy, confidence, flexibility, these kinds of positive mental states, they can be developed through the work that you're doing. So one of the things I really like about the Padmaloka support team, just rejoicing in their merits, is they are very helpful and very friendly. I must rejoice in Stiramani, actually. Last night I went to the wrong place to get a snack before bedtime. And he just approached me quite sensitively and said, we would prefer it if you went to the... I thought, oh, yeah, of course. I've gone to the wrong place, haven't I? But he did it so skillfully. So skillfully, so nicely. And I just felt a twit, you know. I got to the wrong place. But he did it so well. And, well, if you're a receptionist, you need to be friendly with customers. If you're a shop manager, you need to feel meta towards your team. If you're a salesman, you need confidence and mindfulness and flexibility. Yeah? If you're a welfare officer, you need a good quantum of patience and empathy. It's effort of a specific kind. Lastly, maintaining. This is about maintaining arisen, skillful mental states. So there you are, enjoying a skillful and resourceful mental state at work. You're feeling warm towards people. You're engaged with your work. And then something comes along which upsets you or goes wrong. The deal doesn't come off. The meeting is cancelled. Yeah, the computer crashes. The customer pulls out. Yeah, or your colleague gets ill and dumps all this work on you. Are you able to maintain your positive mental state? Yeah, sometimes it's not easy to do that. But it's a specific kind of effort that keeps that going. The conditions are constantly changing. So this is the four right efforts. It's a very particular practice that's suited to right livelihood. But you can practice it in whatever job you're working in or if you're unemployed. And it's all part of perfect effort, the sixth limb of the Eightfold Path. So much for team-based right livelihood and the four right efforts at work and practicing virya at work. I'll say a few more things and then I'll conclude. Another aspect, of course, of team-based right livelihood is the bigger vision. Yeah, we've got this practical teaching of the four right efforts, but within Sri Ratna we have a bigger vision for the world and right livelihood. And sometimes we call that the Bodhisattva ideal, the altruistic dimension, spreading the message of the Buddha out into the world using the medium of work. And our example as a business is so important. How we behave, how we conduct ourselves at work is so important in this regard. So we call it the new society, or even the big society. Building the Buddha land, yeah, is another way we talk about it. So Rupert Murdoch, please take note. So here's a quote from Sangharakshita. Unless your work is your meditation is not meditation. So we can be sincere in our practice of metta and mindfulness on the cushion, but can we take it out into the world of work? Our example really matters. We're engaging in something skillful in team-based right livelihood, and that's part of the broadest vision of the Tri Ratna Buddhist community. Yeah? Remembering we're actually trying to have a positive effect on the wider society. Okay, it's a bit small, but it has an effect on society. It's doing something. And that's very, very important for us to remember that. It brings meaning to our work. It can be a challenge to remember that sometimes, because we get so focused on the little tasks that we're doing. We're actually serving a much bigger vision, something much bigger than us. We're serving the Dharma. Also, it can be a challenge to the ego. There are times when your ego will be challenged by working on it for a bigger vision. It means that your particular tendency to want to be the centre of the universe and have everything organised, I'm talking about myself here, and have everything organised around you, gets challenged by this bigger vision. And sometimes that's quite painful. You can feel quite burned by that. Your ego gets burned. But it's a skillful burning. It's a skillful burning. It's not really a loss. Yeah, it's the death of something that actually hinders you and holds you back from making progress on the path. Most of you will probably know about this particular image of Kwong Duk, the burning monk, 1963. Now, I know he was making a protest about persecution of Buddhism. But for me, it's also a little bit of it's an image which symbolises this death of the ego that you sometimes experience in right livelihood, where your little need to be important kind of has to go in some way. So this bigger vision can bring great meaning to our lives. I just want to say a little bit about Alain de Botton, the philosopher. He's written a very good book called The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, where he goes into this whole area of meaning at work. And he writes a very good book about many kinds of different jobs that people do in the UK today. From large-scale biscuit manufacturing through to an artist painting a tree in the middle of a field. And his conclusion, surveying modern work, is a lot of the time, work is just simply a distraction for us from facing the fact of our own death. So I'll just read you the final paragraph of the whole book. So drink this in. This is good stuff. Let death find us as we are building up our matchstick protests against its waves. Our work will have at least distracted us. It will have provided a perfect bubble in which to invest our hopes for perfection. It will have focused our immeasurable anxieties on a few relatively small-scale and achievable goals. It will have given us a sense of mastery. It will have made us respectfully tired. It will have put food on the table. It will have kept us out of greater trouble. Well, I don't know about you, but I find that summary of modern-day work quite realistic, but also pretty uninspiring. Pretty uninspiring. I think that work can be so much more than what he's talking about there. And team-based right livelihood, for me, is so much more than that. And one of the aspects that I really appreciate about team-based right livelihood is the art, is the craft that we use at work. We are using tools all the time, and these can bring great satisfaction and meaning. We're using tools like laptop computers, cash tools, pens, tape measures, knives, the internet, tape guns, forklift trucks. We're using them all the time, and they're tools, and we can be artists that use them with craft. And this craftsmanship can be summed up in a short poem, which I will finish this talk on. Somehow this poem kind of encapsulates everything I've been talking about, really. So I'll read it, and that's the end. So here you go, you're ready. It's a good poem. The Pitchfork by Seamus Heaney. Of all the implements, the pitchfork was the one that came near to an imagined perfection. When he tightened his raised hand and aimed with it, it felt like a javelin, accurate and light. So whether he played the warrior or the athlete, or worked in earnest in the chaff and sweat, he loved its grain of tapering, dark-fleshed, flecked ash, grown satiny from his own natural polish. Riveted steel, turned timber, burnish, grain, smoothness, straightness, roundness, length and sheen, sweat cured, sharpened, balanced, tested, fitted. The springiness, the click and dart of it. And then when he thought of probes that reached the farthest, he would see the shaft of a pitchfork sailing past, evenly, imperturbably through space. Its prongs starlit and absolutely soundless. But has learned at last to follow that simple lead past its own aim, out to another side, where perfection or nearness to it is imagined, not in the aiming, but the opening hand. Thank you.